Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer. Chapter 2, No Quarter for the Blue Menace.
Previous chapter, I introduced myself. I am Donald McQueen, bibliographer, and began to tell you of my adventures, starting with the day I found the ear trumpet of death in the anteroom of the Fellows Library at my college, Timor Mortis, winners of University Challenge in 1928 and again in 2006. The college name is, of course, taken from its ancient motto, Timor Mortis non conturbat me, which is usually translated as, "The fear of death discombobulates me not." After breakfast, the next morning, kedgeree, accompanied of course by Schickel's tomato ketchup, the preferred ketchup of bibliographers and certainly better than Gruber's, I donned my smock and returned to the library, where I fully intended to take up again my study of the Codex Asinorum of Scrotus. I entered the oak-panelled anteroom and was astonished to find the librarian, Hogg, standing before me, evidently alive and not dead. "Good heavens, Hogg," I cried. "I thought you were dead and not alive."
"No, sir, I am very much alive."
"But I, someone, found your body on the steps of the library only last night, or this morning."
"Ah, that was not me, sir. That was my father, Old Hogg, the librarian."
"Are you not Old Hogg, the librarian?"
"No, sir, I am Young Hogg, the librarian's son. Now the librarian."
"But you look exactly like him."
"There is a certain family likeness, sir, but I am 37 years younger than my late father."
"Are you? Good Lord, man." I hurried past him and into the library, wondering what on earth to make of his story. Was he actually Old Hogg, pretending to be his own son? That was idiotic. Was there perhaps a Hogg the Third, who looked exactly the same as Old Hogg and Young Hogg, and was waiting only for his father to die so that he, too, could take over as librarian? Would we never escape an endless dynasty of identical Hogs? Once safely inside the library, I went to the little sentry box where the librarian's assistant sat, and rapped upon the panel. It creaked open to reveal the assistant, a very personable young woman of about 20, with beautiful eyes like those of a young donkey, who asked if she could help me. I naturally did not speak to her, but wrote down on a yellow order slip the shelf mark of the library's copy of the first printed edition of the Codex Asinorum of Scrotus, along with my name and rank, and presented it to her. She rolled the slip into a ball and neatly popped it into the tiny pannier worn by one of a group of three brown mice who were sitting waiting on the counter before her. She opened a little door at the right-hand end of the counter, my right hand, you understand, not hers, and the mouse scampered through it with my order slip upon its back. The assistant closed the little door and smiled. The library had once been troubled by mice, which had gnawed upon the spines of all the books dated around 1611, I have no idea why, and had eaten, then urinated upon the remains of, the library's copy of John Henry Newman's little-known tract, A Dead Goat in a Frock Coat. Old Hogg had suggested that the mice were all Jesuits, and objected to the King James Bible, but that seemed a little far-fetched to me. Would Jesuitical mice be so offended by the Tractarian movement that they would demolish Newman's tedious, but broadly Romanizing, pamphlet? I fancied not. It had been Hogg's idea not to exterminate the mice, as several other Oxford colleges had done, but to recruit them to the library staff. Now, paid with toasted cheese, garnished with Schickel's tomato ketchup, the preferred ketchup of library-based rodents everywhere, they had ceased to be a nuisance, and become instead useful and well-disciplined couriers of order slips and other small documents to and from the library's vaults. For this reason, I had ceased to bring my beloved cat, Dogrel, into the library with me. It was impossible to stop him eating mice. While they were vermin, no one turned a hair, but eating the library staff was frowned upon. And so now I had to leave him in my lodgings while I plied my bibliographical trade. The assistant closed her shutter, and I was again alone in the library. I took up my usual chair beneath the bust of Clarkson Kent and gazed out of the window onto the great quad. It was deserted, save, of course, for the statues of Alan Titchmarsh and Barnaby the Bear, two of the most notorious scoundrels to have read classics and music, respectively, at Timor Mortis. The bear's story about having been taught to sing by birds was, of course, an outrageous lie and an insult to his alma mater. They faced each other across the quad, like two evil spirits, one tall but stooping, his face distorted with wicked glee, the other short and plump, hairy and naked save for an ill-tied cravat, with the expression of a smug carnivore on his brazen face. Then I saw another figure. It was tall and thin and cloaked in black, and crept from the shadows next the entrance to Staircase 6. It sidled along the side wall towards the south arch. For a moment I was taken aback. Could this be Death, seeking his ear trumpet, or perhaps merely creeping towards his next appointment? But no, I recognised the peculiar gait of the figure, and his brown tasselled belt and man-bag. This was one of the mincing friars who had caused such consternation around in Oxford recently with their attempts to sell indulgences to the students and staff. Seeing the friar reminded me of a printed notice that had recently been circulated in the college, warning both against the activities of these friars and of a peculiar individual who called himself Professor Diogenes Swift and was engaged in similarly shady dealings. I should have reported the friar to the college's domestic tyrant, but I was comfortable in my chair and could not be bothered. And at that moment, the library's copy of the Codex was delivered to me. Not by a mouse, of course, that would be absurd, but by young Hogg himself. He uttered the conventional Latin warning not to handle the book amiss, nor drop it from a pier end or any like place, and vanished. I opened the great folio, took out my notes, my pen and ink bottle, and tried to concentrate upon the mystery which lay before me. But I could not. My thoughts returned to the hard lump in the back pocket of my smock. I could resist no longer, and drew out the trumpet and fitted it to my ear hole. I seemed to be transported back through time, but not so very far in space, to the period when Great Uncle Bulgaria, that most learned and erudite of the Wombles, was a student at Timor Mortis. Indeed, we seem to be attending a college ball back in 1780, when Bulgaria was a lad. At that time, there was minuetting in the morning, and the evenings were, I am reliably informed, minuetting mad. Mr. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was the talk of the town, and forgetting to be minuetting was, apparently, seen as letting the other minuetters down. In fact, there were only three Wombles at Oxford at that time, and they were, I regret to say, being persecuted by the Smurfs. At that period, and we're talking of the 1780s, Bulgaria was studying Wombling at Timor Mortis. Elgin was a student of the same subject and of biochemistry at Ray Winston Hall, then of course known as Falstaff Hall, and Tuvalu was at St. Lancelot's on a Buggins scholarship, reading classics. Bulgaria was the only one to realise his true potential, however, and thus to bring glory to his college. Elgin, perhaps inevitably, lost his marbles after experimenting with psychorealic drugs, which he had distilled from his own tears. He came to believe that all human endeavour was worthless and pointless, and that he, as a Womble, could achieve less than nothing. So he returned to Wimbledon Common, where he lay down on a hillock and waited for death to claim him. Tuvalu went the other way and developed an extreme case of delusional narcissism. He coveted the post of Supreme Librarian of the Bibliobiblion, Oxford's great university library, founded, of course, by Sir Thomas Bibliobobbly in the 16th century, and long the home of one of the nation's finest copies of the Codex Asinorum. Tuvalu believed himself a great scholar, of great physical strength and agility, irresistibly attractive to Lady Wombles, and ultimately a god who could both burrow effortlessly through the earth and fly high above it. He died when trying to prove this to a fellow student by stepping from the top of the tower of St. Lancelot's. Ironically, his claim that he could burrow effortlessly into the earth was, at least partly, proven by this act, albeit it was his last. In those days, there were a great many Smurfs in Oxford. Some were enrolled in the university, but the majority were indigent, living on the streets and preying on the simple townsfolk mercilessly. They gave the Wombles hell. Indeed, we found Smurfs to be prejudiced against any creature which did not have blue skin, fur, or feathers. Thus, they were only able to accept their own kind, Sonic the Hedgehog, Huckleberry Hound, Woody Woodpecker, Cookie Monster, Mr. Freeze, and the Great Gonzo. In this more enlightened age, we do not tolerate Smurfs at all, and have set traps for them round the city. If a Smurf is caught on university property, it is treated to university justice by the Smurf Hunter Royale, a post established under Victoria for the preservation of the world from the blue menace. Happily, Smurfs keep away from Knoxford these days, and it is some years since I have seen one alive or dead. I suppose I should check the trap, which is still set up in the college gardens. I have not looked at it for several years. Who knows what bleached bones it may contain? As the auditory vision of Timor Mortis in the 1780s faded, I heard the drunken voice of Bulgaria trying in vain to encourage the quintet to play the wombling song.
Play it. Underground, overground, wombling free. Come on, you bastards, play along. The Wombles of Wimbledon, come on, are we? Bloody do it, you bastards. I'm paying your wages. Making good use of it.
The trumpet tore my ears away from Timor Mortis College of the 18th century, and once again I found myself in the world of the wireless with the BBC Radio Knoxford.
And now on Radio Knoxford, the second part of the latest story in our series of Victorian Tales of Terror. In the first episode, the Count discovered that he could calm his unquiet bowels by drinking blood, ideally human blood, and killed first a laundry maid, then a schoolboy, and then a tot from the Transylvanian Municipal Orphanage. His newly fragrant emissions allowed him to make friends and enjoy natural human intercourse for the first time. He groped a barmaid, tickled several cats, danced with a drunken sailor, and enjoyed carnal relations with a beautiful tramp and a lady postman who had just delivered a most mysterious package to his castle. Find out what was in that package in this, the second episode of Count Flatula, a Vampire with a Problem. Count Flatula by Abraham Stoker. Starring Featherston Crumbleback and Simon Callow III.
Pleasured the post lady, and she had departed with the happy knowledge that she had been entered by a member of the aristocracy, I turned my attention to the most mysterious package she had brought for me. I sometimes order soil taken from the garden of a nurse or a nun from a special catalogue, which is supplied to discerning gentlemen with such tastes. But I had not made a nun or nurse soil order lately, so was deeply intrigued by this parcel, which I could only call most mysterious. I opened it slowly, and found it to contain a cardboard box, inside which was a smaller cardboard box, inside which was a severed human hand. It was a small, pale, smelly hand, and I wondered if it might be that of the little boy I had killed and drained of blood some weeks earlier. Beneath the hand was a note, written in jagged letters, reading, "I know who you are. I know what you have done. You will pay for your crime. I will kill you and you will rot in hell." Signed, "A well-wisher." How could this well-wisher have traced me to my magnificent castle? Then I remembered that I had been a little careless when I killed the boy, and had left my bicycle in the graveyard where I had abandoned his little corpse. In the saddlebag was my copy of the 1868 edition of Fischer's Romanian translation of the Codex Asinorum of Scrotus, in which I seemed to recall I had written my name and address. When I came to think about it, I had been a little careless with the other killings, too. I had carved my initials, C.F., on the tree in which I had strung up the young woman, and when I had finished sucking on the baby, I tied a piece of string around its neck and attached a label on which I had written, "I am sorry to have killed your child," signed Count Flatula, Castle Flatula, Grim Mountain, near Slatina, Transylvania. Perhaps on reflection I should have been a little more circumspect.
Extract from the Journal of Anthony Plumstring, Attorney at Law, Pimlico, 18th June, 1888. I have received a most peculiar communication from a Transylvanian nobleman. He commands me to arrange furnished lodgings for him in town, and to meet his ship, the Saucy Gwendolyn, on the quayside tomorrow. He sends a generous sum in gold, but I cannot rid myself of the gravest forebodings at the prospect. I cannot say why, but his letter filled my heart with terror, and I cannot help but believe this man to be some kind of fiend. 19th June, 1888. I met the Count's ship as commanded this morning in Portsmouth. The day was stormy. The sea lashed the shore while rain streamed from the heavens, and the wind howled like a damned soul. I thought no ship could make land, but as soon as the Saucy Gwendolyn hove into sight, a strange change came upon the scene. Around the ship a gentle light seemed to play, and our nostrils caught a wonderful, sweet scent, driven upon us with the stinging waters of the storm. All was calm around the vessel, which seemed to glide in a pool of pale purple light. Soon it came close to the quayside, and the wind and rain died away, and the noise of the storm retreated. My betrothed, Lucy Honeypot, was at my side, having travelled with me from London on the railway. She lowered the hood of her cloak, and let her golden hair stream out in the now gentle, fragrant breeze. She turned to me and remarked that she could smell lilacs, or perhaps violets. A stray dog, which was hunting rats on the quay at the time, began to sing. As the ship drew closer, the wonderful fragrance grew stronger. The sun emerged from behind the clouds, and two sailors, who were fighting aboard a skiff tied up nearby, stopped thumping one another, and one began to braid the other's hair. The ship appeared to be unmanned. It glided up to the quay and stopped dead, as if stayed by an invisible hand. After a moment, a tall figure emerged from the wheelhouse. He was dressed in purple silks of the finest cut, and the heavenly scent we had detected seemed to grow stronger still. His face was long and dark and ghastly, with sunken eyes which appeared to glow with a yellowish light, and a mouth like the flap of a coal scuttle. He smiled,
showing his long, pointed, yellow teeth, and spoke.
May I introduce myself? I am Count Flatula, and you, I presume, are Mr. Anthony Plumstring, attorney at law of Pimlico. And who is this very, very charming young lady with the golden hair streaming out beside you?
Despite his repulsive features and nasty foreign accent, there was something about the Count which rendered him attractive. It was as if I were somehow already his friend, his admirer, even his brother. I was about to introduce Lucy when she cast off her wet cloak, ran forward, and embraced the Count. I was astonished, but at the same time felt it was entirely natural. I wanted to cast off my own coat and take Flatula in my arms, but I resisted the impulse. I heard Lucy whispering to the Count, no doubt introducing herself formally and asking whether his journey from Transylvania had been a tolerable one. I noticed him adjusting her bustle, which I thought a great kindness under the circumstances, forgiving him at once the social error. He was, after all, a foreign nobleman, quite ignorant of our manners and conventions, including the unspoken rule that a gentleman should not adjust the bustle of a lady who is betrothed to another. After some minutes, I persuaded Lucy to leave the Count's side, and we all took a carriage to the railway station. We boarded the train to London.
All aboard for London town.
Under the influence of the Count's wonderful fragrance, the journey seemed to pass in a moment, and before I knew it, we were in the metropolis.
London town, all change.
In a few seconds, it seemed, I was conveying the Count up the stairs to the rooms I had found for him. He seemed greatly delighted with them, and gave me several more gold coins before bidding me farewell. Shortly afterwards, when I had quitted his company and returned to my office, I began to feel rather differently. The vision of the Count's hideous visage swam before my face, and I felt nothing but loathing for him. That he had touched my beloved was a pain I could scarcely endure, and, without what now seemed the evil enchantment of his miraculous scent, I perceived him to be what I had at first thought him, a fiend of the vilest, foulest kidney.
Was Plumstring right in his assessment of the Count? Well, of course he was, but how would he defend himself from the Transylvanian's magical gases? And how keep his betrothed, the beautiful Lucy Honeypot, from the Count's clutches? Find out in the next thrilling installment of Count Flatula, a vampire with a problem.
I decided not to remove the ear trumpet from my ear at this point, but to leave it in and find out what was coming next on BBC Radio Knoxford. It was a decision I rather regretted, as it was one of the worst things on the wireless.
And now on BBC Radio Knoxford, it's time for this evening's episode of our rural drama, an everyday story of monstrous folk, the Archer's family. And in the village shop, Jennifer and Susan are discussing the guillotine, which has recently been erected on the village green.
There is a bunch of farmers whose mawkish melodramas would make us all sell farmers, the Archer's family. When suddenly they're cheerful, we know that something fearful is poised to make them tearful, the Archer's family.
Rocks are crass and truthless. The cast is quaint and toothless. But they could be more ruthless.
Oh, no!
Hooray!
No for that Shuler Archer.
Hooray!
The Archer's family. Oh, bloomin' heck erupted. One knob dropped or corrupted. But then they're interrupted. The Archer's family. Unexpected, we find ourselves subjected to plot lines interjected. The Archer's family. There's billing and there's cooing. There's booing and there's hooing. There's something ghastly brewing in the Archer's family.
I quickly withdrew the ear trumpet of death from my ear. It was time to cease my adventuring for the moment and return to the mystery of the Codex Asinorum. If anything in the universe, in all of time and reality, could convince me of that, it was the Archer's family. Bloomin' heck. That was The Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer. Today's chapter was sponsored by the Bibliographical Society of London and by Schickel's Tomato Ketchup, the preferred ketchup of bibliographers and much more delicious than Gruber's. It was written and performed by Paul W. Nash, with musical themes borrowed from Vic Mizzi, Arthur Wood, Mike Batt, John Williams, and Mozart. Next time in The Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer.
Coming soon from Milton Keynes Pictures, the ultimate story of a mighty champion fallen from the stars. Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, the faith, hope, and charity of superheroism, and the greatest of these three is Superman. But mild-mannered Clarkson Kent of Idaho was not the only Kryptonian to fall to Earth and be adopted by a human family. Great Britain has her own hero. Meet the Chav Superman.
I could leap a tall building at a single bound, but I can't be arsed.
From the Thames estuary he comes, powerful beyond our understanding, but lazy, coarse, and spiteful, due to his upbringing by Kevin and Sharon Kelly of Purfleet.
More powerful than a locomotive? Kiss my arse.
Unwilling even to rise from his deck chair, he coarsens everything he touches, and despoils the English language itself.
I could fly faster than a speeding bullet. It'd be a piece of piss, but why the fuck should I?
Look, there, in that deck chair.
It's a giant rotting potato.
It's a bin bag full of shit.
No, it's the Chav Superman. Yes, it's the Chav Superman, strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. The Chav Superman, caring nothing for law and order.
A bank job? Go robbers, I say. I hate those merchant wankers.
Or indeed for equal rights.
With my X-ray vision, I can see your tits.
The Chav Superman, cowardly supporter of the forces of hate and prejudice, who disguised as Ryan Kelly, ill-mannered scrounger and out-of-work bricklayer in a great metropolitan tradition, fights a never-ending battle against truth, justice, and the Department of Work and Pensions.
You want to be rescued? You got your arse into this shit. You can get your own arse out, you fuckwit.
Coming to cinemas soon, Featherstone Crumbleback is the Chav Superman, a truly British superhero. You will believe a man can attract flies.